This is Craig Brown, welcoming you aboard this original oldie recording of my writing. Your cast today is Eleanor Bron, Richard Ingrams, Paul Bailey, Tallulah Brown, A.N. Wilson, and me, Craig Brown. On the occasion of Prince Philip's 90th birthday, Alan Titchmarsh conducts a hard-hitting interview.
As he approaches his 90th birthday, Prince Philip shows little sign of slowing down. It's one of the great privileges, not only of my life, but of my children's lives, that His Most Gracious Royal Highness has agreed to meet me on what is, remarkably, the eve of his 90th birthday. He certainly shows no sign of slowing down. Sir, would I be right in thinking that as you approach your 90th birthday, you show no sign of slowing down?
What a fatuous thing to say. You need your head examined. I mean, if you've got nothing better to ask me.
Oh, marvellous, sir. You certainly show no sign of slowing down. Now, might I take you back to your childhood, sir? By all accounts, it was in royal terms pretty unconventional.
What a damn fool question. Is there going to be much more of this?
You were born nearly 90 years ago, sir. That's a remarkable achievement, especially for someone of your advanced years. Does it really feel that long?
What a gushy little man. I haven't the foggiest idea who he is.
You are now, sir, by my reckoning, the longest-serving consort in British history. What does that mean to you?
What do you think it means? Get on with it, man.
The fact that you are now the longest-serving consort in British history, sir, what does that mean to
you? What do you think it means? I mean, how long is a piece of string? What's the square root of 29? How am I meant to know? Are you completely daft? Who do you think I am? What's the point? Where's the sense? Who are you? What the hell are you doing in here? Who let him in?
Tell me about your naval career, sir.
Well, it was a career and it was naval. Nothing more to say.
There must have been some amusing or exciting moments, sir. Do any spring to mind?
No.
Marvellous. And then, in 1947, you married Her Royal Highness the Queen.
Absolutely none of your business.
How important was fatherhood to you, sir?
What do you mean by that?
Fatherhood, sir. Was it important to you?
In what way?
I was wondering whether, to you, sir, fatherhood was important, sir.
It depends what you mean by important. Depends what you mean by fatherhood. A damn fool question. Next you'll be trying to tell me that 2 and 2 makes 5. Are you on something? How much more of my time do you intend to take up?
Wonderful. You certainly show little sign of slowing down, sir. Incidentally, sir, I've brought... Incidentally, sir, I brought my tongue along with me, sir. I wondered if you'd be so gracious as to allow me to take this opportunity to lick your...
What a ghastly little man.
Oh, but thank you most kindly, most gracious, sir.
At Brownton Abbey, the Earl is driven to upbraid his trusty butler, Carson, on a point of etiquette. It matters less how a man handles his fork, Carson, than how he handles his womenfolk.
Yes, my lord.
After all, Carson, a fork is just a fork. But when all is said and done, a woman is a human being. Enough of this chit-chat, Carson. I fear it cannot be long before the First World War breaks out, and the world as we know it is altered forever.
Might I have a word, my lord?
Oh, can't it wait, Carson? I'm up to my neck in cufflinks, and my iPod is on the blink, dash it.
I do apologise, my lord, but it cannot wait. I wish to tender my resignation.
Your resignation? I say, Carson, isn't this a trifle hasty? What, pray, is your reason?
I'd rather not say, my lord.
Look here, Carson, I insist that you tell me. Now there's a good fellow, you at least owe me that.
It's about that chocolate cake, my lord.
Ah, yes. The chocolate cake.
One of the undermaids served it to her ladyship without providing the requisite spoon and fork. Consequently, the chocolate smeared itself all over her ladyship's face.
The poor darling looked like nothing so much as a negro minstrel. Had the slave trade not been abolished by my good friend Lord Palmerston some 50 years thither, the Countess of Grantham might have found herself
chained to the oar of a slave ship and rowing herself to the West Indies, even as we speak, Carson.
I shall never forgive myself, my lord, and for that reason I wish to tender my resignation.
I won't hear of it, Carson. We must let bygones be bygones. Far better that I should dock 6 months' wages from your salary and forget all about it.
I promise you, my lord, you shall never regret your decision.
It behoves the well-born to overlook the minor misdemeanours of those less intelligent than themselves, Carson. And with poor Archduke Franz Ferdinand shortly to be shot and the First World War looming, who can say what the future will hold?
Yes, my lord. Will that be all, my lord?
And now we dip into the archives to hear John Gielgud reading a selection of his letters.
To Laurence Olivier, November the 11th, 1978. Darling Larry, I rarely find time to watch the television set owing to pressure of work in the theatre. How immensely gratifying it is to be in demand. But I fancy it was you I happened to glimpse behind the reception desk in that splendid Crossroads television series when I perchanced to switch it on the other day. I must say you carried off the difficult role of Amy Turtle quite magnificently, bringing all your magisterial authority to a most interesting portrayal of a human being trapped between the pressures imposed by the workplace, answering the telephone, taking late bookings for chalets, and the pressures of home life, getting to the corner shop for a tin of tomato soup before it closes, etc. I doubt if I shall ever forget the suggestion of misery tinged with fortitude that you managed to inject into that chilling line, "Whose is the coffee?" It was without doubt your finest piece of work since Henry V. Do forgive me, Larry, if I have made the most ghastly mistake. And it was not you playing Abby Turtle, but some dreadful old ham actress who looked uncannily like you, if that was indeed the case. I really cannot imagine why the producers overlooked you for a role that would have suited you to the T, particularly when you are in such crying need of half-decent work. Bless you, dear. You have all my sympathy. All of which brings me round to my point. I am directing a season of Sophocles at the Old Vic in the autumn. I am hoping you will be an absolute darling and agree to play Oedipus opposite my own feeble Jocasta. To Dr. Ian Paisley, May the 5th, 1972. I simply cannot be bothered with intrigues, lies, and recriminations. When I bumped into you, a perfect stranger in Piccadilly, and told you how much I admired your white ankle socks, adding as an aside that you also had the most beautiful hands, I had no idea your mind was already occupied. How was I to realise that you were busy leading a demonstration of 10,000 Ulstermen, bless them, against this, that, and the other? One cannot be expected to notice simply everything. You bellowed to me to get out of the way, yet I was only being sweet. I sent you a bit of a bossy boots, darling Ian. If you cannot take compliments, then I shall no longer bother to offer them, and then you won't like it, will you? And you so marvellously tall and broad-shouldered, and with such a twinkle in your eye. Oh, but there I go again.
Gilly Cooper's new Bonkbuster is set in the glamorous, sexy world of antiques.
And this,
said Guy, picking up another priceless exhibit, his eyes still fixed on Amelia's full, high, incredibly springy breasts, soft and yielding, yes, but also ruthlessly ambitious and thrusting,
is one of my finest pieces of handcrafted antique china. It's from the 16th century, which of course actually means it was made sometime in the 1700s.
Amelia noticed Lord Guy's long, long, really very long fingers clutching the priceless Sèvres vase. How she wished they were even now unbuttoning her expensive wet-look silk blouse, which cost £375 from Prada in London's impossibly glamorous New Bond Street. I love him, she sobbed herself in a frenzy of despair, whilst maintaining a look of deepest composure on her face, covered as it was with a layer of perfect spot-free skin.
Oh, hang it, who cares about bloody china?
Sighed Lord Guy impatiently, as with a manly swing he threw the priceless Sèvres vase over his rippling, feverishly sweating left shoulder.
All I want, Amelia, you hugely successful but nonetheless strangely insecure international beauty, is to bury myself deep inside your smouldering breast.
Amelia swooned. Mon Dieu, she gasped, as she watched her breast smoulder in his hugely successful hands. At moments of passion, the hot, red, moist French blood of her mother, the impossibly glamorous but desperately unhappy Comtesse Madeleine de Villefranche, seemed to course through her tongue. At that moment, the priceless 16th-century Sèvres vase shattered against the priceless 15th-century Ming serving dish, and both fell headlong onto a priceless 36-piece Louis XIV dinner service, smashing it into hundreds of little pieces.
Whoops! Don't Ming us, we'll Ming you,
said Lord Guy, bringing out his impossibly long and hugely successful manhood, which glistened like the moist nose on a healthy pedigree Labrador puppy. Amelia clutched her sides with laughter at his brilliant pun. Sèvres, you jolly well right, she quipped in response, her smouldering breasts springing up and down like excited dachshunds at dinner time. Bonjour, she added once again, her passionate French blood seeming to take control of her body as she raced headlong onto the field of passion.
The melancholic German writer W. G. Sebald recalls his time on holiday on the beach. The sky loomed over me like a bright blue package containing heavy objects about to fall on the world from a great height. Strawberry or orange, mate, said the man. I had asked for an ice lolly, and now the salesman in the van was cross-questioning me as to my exact meaning. A mivy, I replied. I know that, mate, he responded curtly, but strawberry or orange? It was then that I remembered that orange is the colour of the robes that adorn the corpses of women in Delhi who have died hideous deaths, a haunting and melancholy detail I have never been able to shed from my memory when ordering a lolly. Orange, please, I said mournfully. The mivy, I was later to discover, is named after Dr. Hans Mivy of Zurich, the 18th century apothecary whose Almanach de Mivy, first published in Rome in 1781, the very same year that a 92-year-old woman was burnt as a witch in Bury St. Edmunds, pioneered the notion of an iced comestible wrapped around another iced comestible, the two of them placed on a stick and priced accordingly. Yet the mivy iced lolly has always seemed to me godforsaken in its bewildered iciness, an iciness brought into savage relief by the plaintive flavouring of its outer lollyhood, so that the insertion of the mivy into the mouth induces a terrifying sense of déjà vu in the hapless consumer, as though mankind itself were frozen for those few minutes on a stick to be placed into the mouth of nothingness until it melts, the sole memento of our existence, a few fast-fading orange drips on the chin of oblivion. With the sun setting behind me, reminding me of a bad egg thrown haphazardly into a darkening bin, I end my first day on the sodden beach. On this very day, 397 years ago, something unspeakably dreadful happened. But what? I spot a congealed chip on the worn beach, pick it up, suck on it, and struggle to remember. At Brownton Abbey, events are moving with their customary speed.
Might I have a word, my lord?
Can't it wait, Carson?
I'm sorry to bother you, my lord, but it's just around noon and it's... it appears the First World War has ended.
That's marvellous news, Carson, particularly for our boys at the front. War is a tiresome business, particularly when it leads to bloodshed. A human life, Carson, is a precious thing.
Indeed so, my lord.
One moment, Carson. You mentioned the First World War. Did you mean to imply that a second may be on the way?
Indeed, my lord. I regret to say that Mr. Churchill has just this minute announced the commencement of the Second World War.
That's terrible news, Carson, particularly for our boys on the front. A human life is a precious thing, Carson.
One has barely grown acclimatized to the First World War, and now they tell us that a second is on its way. The inconvenience.
Might I have a word, my lady?
Can't it wait, Carson?
This telegram has just arrived, my lady.
The good news is that the Second World War is at last drawing to a close. Mr. Churchill himself has just been good enough to send us this telegram. He says that Mr. Hitler has committed suicide in a bunker.
A bunker? What sort of fellow commits suicide in a bunker, I ask you? It was quite clearly no gentleman. That dreadful moustache.
Might I have a word with you, m'lady?
Can't it wait, Carson?
The news has just reached us, m'lady, that the England football team, under the captaincy of Mr. Robert Moore, has been victorious in its effort to win the 1966 World Cup.
A solitary cup, and not a saucer in sight. It's the last straw.
That's marvellous news, Carson, and a welcome boost to our beleaguered nation as we struggle to come to terms with our loss of empire.
I wanted the Germans to win.
Me too.
Might I have a word, my lord?
Can't it wait, Carson?
This telegram has just arrived, my lord.
Bad news, I'm afraid, Carson. Please assemble the household staff this minute. Far better they should hear the dreadful news from me. Ah, here you all are. I know it will come as a dreadful blow to all of you. I don't know how to put this, but... The Beatles have decided to go their separate ways.
You mean they've split up?
Daisy, mind your language.
Sorry, Miss Patmore, it's the shock.
There, there, Daisy. Dry those eyes.
It is never pleasant when a popular singing combination decides to part company. That these four doughty Liverpudlians meet with considerable success in their separate careers, upon which they have embarked, is the best for which we can hope.
Not me. It's Yoko I like.
Me too.
Such catchy tunes. She admires you. Yes, yes, yes. You make me dizzy, Miss Elizabeth. Why don't we do it in the...
Might I have a word, my lord?
Can't it wait, Carson?
The news has just arrived, my lord, that the Prime Minister, Mr. Edward Heath, has this instant placed the country on a 3-day week.
Good. I love a double-dip recession.
Me too. Does that mean we're going down the plug hole?
Daisy, mind your language.
Sorry, Miss Patmore.
There, there, Daisy, dry those eyes. Might I have a word, my lord?
Can't it wait, Carson?
Word has just come through, my lord, that the British forces have recaptured the Falkland Islands. I thought you should be the first to know, my lord.
Excellent news, Carson. In the fullness of time, it should do much to restore national morale.
Not for me, it won't. It's General Galtieri I like.
Me too.
Might I have a word, my lord?
And now Peter Mandelson reads from his memoirs. David Miliband approached me in a corridor. He told me that Alistair Darling had seen Gordon and told him that Harriet and Jack were putting it about that Ed Balls had told Douglas Alexander that Ed Miliband and Andy Burnham had been telling people that Alistair Darling had seen Gordon and told him that Harriet and Jack were putting it about that Ed Balls had told Douglas Alexander that Ed Miliband and Andy Burnham had been telling people that I had been seen in a corridor talking to David Miliband. Frankly, I was startled. I had no wish to see our historic fourth term as a left-of-centre progressive government undermined by tittle-tattle. So I felt that I had not only a duty, but a responsibility, both to my party and to the country as a whole, to let Tony know exactly what was being said. So I approached David Miliband in a corridor and told him that apparently people were saying that Alistair Darling had seen Gordon and told him that Harriet and Jack were putting it about that Ed Balls had told Douglas Alexander that Ed Miliband and Andy Burnham.
From the memoirs of Margaret Rhodes, Woman of the Royal Bedchamber.
The Queen Mother had simple tastes. She took every opportunity to have lunch al fresco. She simply adored eating out of doors in the Scottish Highlands. If rain looked likely, she would simply get the staff to bring a suitable shelter up the hill, plus chairs, dining table, silver, and so forth. Such fun, she would say, urging them on with a stick she had sharpened with her trusty penknife. Her staff were all utterly devoted. We would have worked for nothing, but being an angel, she insisted on paying us, largely in boiled sweets. Those who had served her for over 50 years would be given barley sugar, the rest Fox's Glacier mints. At the turn of the century, many of them were well over 90 years old, but she never allowed them to retire, insisting it would make them bone lazy. Every now and then, one old retainer or another would collapse and die in service, but she was always sympathetic, even if it had involved a spillage at table. "These things happen," she would smile, ringing a discreet bell attached to the table to summon the controller of the royal coffins to make the necessary arrangements. I was in my 80th year when, carrying her piggyback over a roaring Scottish burn, I stupidly slipped and fell. Luckily, the Queen Mother fell on top of me and so didn't get wet. She stayed there without complaint until rescued by a kindly gilly. I was underwater for a good minute or two, so wasn't able to offer my apologies until later. From that moment on, I always kept a pair of goggles and a snorkel about my person, just in case.
From the archives, the novelist D.H. Lawrence pens a thank you letter to Nancy Cunard.
My dear Lady Cunard, thank you so much for that lovely stay last weekend. We both enjoyed ourselves very much. It was really very kind of you to have us. I do hope my little diversion on Saturday evening wasn't too awfully inconvenient for you, and that your servants have managed to get most of the mud out of the carpets from something you said, or was it just a look? I came away thinking that I may, in your eyes, have done something wrong. If so, I can only apologise, but what is a man if he cannot seize the moment to strip off all his loathsome lily-livered clothes and wrestle his fellow man naked, strong, tumultuous, full of the very urge of life that lies within them, and all in a deep, soft, dirty, real dirty and splodsome sea of mud? You may argue, in your typically grey, bourgeois, corrupt, stinking, decaying way, that I had no right to order your gardeners to load 10, 11, 12 wheelbarrows high with sludge from the ditches, wheel them into the blue drawing-room, and offload them in an area in front of the blazing fire. And you may also argue, you loud-mouthed bitch, that I could at least have rolled up your priceless carpet, symbol of all that is petty and extravagant and worthless in this age, and placed it to one side. Away with your arguments, and into your grey, sniffy, hoity-toity objections. When I rolled with your stable lad in the mud, as we pummeled each other with our fists, and each felt the brute within and the mud without, I at last felt free and open and alive and triumphant and, yes, pure. There is nothing dirty in mud. This pervasive and wretched belief in household cleanliness is the sign of a decrepit age. Your piggish mud hatred fills my blood with contempt. Finally, once again, many thanks for the most marvellous stay. You made us feel so at home. We both came away greatly refreshed and full of wonderful memories of a really terrific weekend. Yours ever, David.
And now Germaine Greer speaks up on behalf of women.
My God, I despair of women sometimes. My whole life and my every breath has been informed with the imprint of my love and respect, admiration indeed, of women. But for Christ's sake, they sometimes let me down. If there is one type of woman I hate, it is a very thin type of woman. And if there's another type of woman who gets up my nose, it's the fatty. And what about those detestable in-betweenies, those spineless wretches who don't have the guts to be one thing or the other? They frankly get on my wick. Not until woman can be truly herself, neither fat nor thin nor in between, can our sisterhood hope to save this doomed planet.
Over breakfast at Brownton Abbey, a variety of unexpected new characters appear at the front door.
More coffee, my lord?
Thank you, Carson. Coffee is a warm, dark beverage much favoured at breakfast. Now, let's see what's in my copy of the Times today. Good heavens! Bad news, everyone. A major earthquake is on its way.
More coffee, my lady?
Thank you, Carson. Whither so far did they say this earthquake might occur, Robert?
Let me see. Oh, no. This I cannot believe.
More coffee, my lord?
Dash it, Carson. This is no time for warm beverages. Be so good as to summon the household at your earliest convenience. Ah, here you all are. There is no cause for alarm, but it says here in the Times that a major earthquake is due in the next few minutes. Apparently it will occur at Downton Abbey, the historic stately home of the Earl of Grantham.
An earthquake can hear at Downton? The presumption of it.
I like earthquakes.
Me too.
And more coffee, Lady Sybil?
I might never have another chance to say this just seconds before this earthquake kills us all. I want everyone to know I love you, Carson, and I'm expecting your baby.
My apologies, everyone. It appears I've misread. It's my spectacles. It doesn't say earthquake at all. In fact, it says flower show.
Shame. I hate flowers.
Me too.
I would entreat you all to return to your duties and to behave as though nothing untoward had occurred. Life is full of events, many of them unspeakable, but we must learn to ignore them.
Beg pardon, my lord, but there is a fishy sort of character at the door.
A fishy sort of character?
Who can that be? Wholly unexpected new character, I'll be bound.
Can't it wait, Carson?
He ventured to say it was a matter of life or death, my lord.
You'd better show him in, Carson. Who on earth can it be? Good lord! It's a killer shark!
Says his name is Mr. Jaws, my lord.
Could someone please tell him to take that silly grin off his face?
Ouch!
Might I have a word, my lord?
Can't it wait, Carson?
Her ladyship appears to have had her legs bitten off by our visitor, my lord.
I love other people's legs being bitten off by sharks.
Me too.
Most unfortunate. As a family, we can ill afford to lose more legs. Someone must say something to Jaws.
Leave it to me. I say, Jaws, old man, there's no reason to be snappy. You seem dreadfully steamed up about something. What is it, old chap? Ouch! Drat! Jaws! Jaws has just eaten my leg!
Oh, dear, my lord, and I'm sorry to inform you, my lord, that he has eaten Lady Sybil.
Inform Mrs. Patmore, could you, Carson, that we shall be one fewer for dinner?
Very good, my lord. Incidentally, a telegram has just arrived.
Can't it wait, Carson? Oh, very well. My goodness, it says that 10,000 Zulus have Downton Abbey surrounded and are preparing to attack.
In my experience, the table manners of the Zulu leave much to be desired.
I love the way they spear people through the stomach and set their homes on fire.
Me too.
You'd better ask them in, Carson.
Very well, my lord.
Oh, and Carson?
Yes, my lord?
While you're about it, would you be good enough to make an appointment for Lady Sybil with Dr. Crippen? I'm told he's awfully reliable.
Very good, my lord. More coffee, my lord.
The grand novelist Anthony Pole reads from his diaries.
Violet and I attended pre-luncheon drinks with the Somersets at Gloucester, then on to the Gloucesters in Somerset. The Devonshires had brought Kent along. Halfway through the luncheon, the butler informed us that Lady Avon was at the door. "Oh, tell her to join us," said Gloucester, drawing up a chair for her. She sat down and was halfway through her main course, medaillon de veau, pomme lyonnaise, épinards à la crème, all perfectly eatable, entertaining us with fulsome praise for a new lemon-scented shower gel, whatever that may be, when it emerged that the butler had misheard. She was not the Lady Avon at all, but the Avon lady.
And now, for an intellectual look at soccer, we turn to Dame A.S. Byatt.
What is the, to my mind, almost mystical allure of soccer? It is at one and the same time geometry transposed into music, architecture by synchronicity, astronomy reconfigured as ballet. My edition of Chambers' Dictionary defines soccer as a short, knitted covering for the foot, usually not reaching the knee. And that definition stands as far as it goes. But to my mind, it is something much more than that, something very different, something that possesses both inner and outer meanings, that somehow evade definition. Football is, above all, a meta-text. I find one can read a game of soccer just as one would read a novel by Cervantes or Dickens, picking it up and putting it down, and placing a bookmark carefully between ball and pitch, so that one may recommence one's perusals later. I watch football for purely aesthetic reasons, as though I were viewing a kinetic sculpture or abstract light show. The things I watch for are all contained in quadrilaterals, concern the movement of round balls and the shifting lines of force and energy made by the players' movements. Watching Gareth Barry pass to Dean Ashton in the mid-season friendly against Finland, I was reminded inescapably of the wonderful collage of blue and yellow seahorses by Henri Matisse, or, perhaps more tellingly, Vermeer's truly sublime young woman reading a letter at an open window. Is she, one wonders, truly pregnant? Or is she, in reality, hiding a Dutch football beneath her peasant blouse?
Princess Diana's butler, Paul Burrell, reads from Volume 9 of his memoirs.
Until now, I have said little about my relationship with Her Majesty the Queen, but the truth must now outweigh the need for me to protect her little secrets. Her Majesty was a lovely lady. She thought the world of me. She would often call by on her nights off. I got used to that telltale knock on the door. She would drum out the opening bars of the national anthem with her clenched fist. That way I knew it was her. I'd open the door, and there she'd be, dressed in casual clothes, a pair of designer denims and a favourite caftan. Often she'd let her hair hang down so it flowed over her creamy shoulders. It gave her the more relaxed and carefree look she had always craved. "You know, you should keep it like that, ma'am. You look truly fabulous," I once ventured, but she looked downcast. "My public would never accept me like that, Paul," she said. "They like me with it up." At that point, she got out her guitar and sang me one of my all-time favourite songs, Ralph McTell's Streets of London. It was a very private moment, which I've decided to write about only after a great struggle. But one thing I know, I will continue to cherish my memory of a special evening of rest and relaxation spent in the company of a very lovely lady.
And now we dip into the archive to hear Virginia Woolf reading from her diaries.
There is no doubt that to talk to Sybil Colfax is very depressing. She mews and mows, won't speak out, complains with one breath, asks pity, but can't be induced to say what is on her mind. Perhaps there is very little there. She makes one's soul flop. Today she came half an hour late in her tiara and white fur, and we headed out. After the usual patter, I managed to thrust in first and grabbed her tiara and hurled it through the window. Her defences crumpled. She flushed and quickened. I seized my chance to give her a quick jab between the ribs, and she buckled and fell. And she started twittering out how I had really hurt her and how her tiara was worth a small fortune. And I said, even smaller now. Stupidly, I turned away, and in that second, Sybil was back up on her feet, pummeling me again and again with those cruel diamond-studded fists, all the while shouting that I was insensitive to her upsets and heartless and interested only in myself. Happily, a large frying pan was close to hand, so I grabbed it and managed to land it on her head, so she went down once again on the floor, bleating and mewling. "Cry, baby," I goaded her as she lay sprawled on the floor. "Cry, baby, cry, baby, cry, baby." "Don't you dare call me that. I'm not, I'm not, I'm not," she yelled back. And I said, "Ha, that just proves that you are. So bad luck, cry, baby." As she lay there, straggled across the floor and twitching like a moth, I took the opportunity to pour a jug of tomato sauce over her white fur. But at that point, Leonard put his head around the door and asked if everything was all right. "Very much so," I said. "Sybil has just popped around, hoping to continue our debate. As you can see, it is all very agreeable, all very civilized."
Christmas comes to Brownton Abbey.
Might I wish you the most jubilant and gracious of Christmases, my dearest?
Oh, Robert, how perfectly sweet of you. What is it? My goodness, Robert, it's just what I wanted, a fresh tiara.
With winter now upon us, Cora, I felt your head might benefit from a little extra covering.
So thoughtful.
Might I have a word, my lord?
Can't it wait, Carson?
There's a mysterious stranger at the door. He says his name is Claus, my lord. Santa Claus. He's accompanied by 4 reindeer, my lord. Claims it's urgent.
You'd better show him in, Carson.
Yo-ho-ho!
The uttering of yo-ho-ho is most dreadfully common, to say nothing of snowy white beards.
And a very Merry Christmas to one and all.
No gentleman ever dresses in a bright red suit with white fur trimmings.
He arrived accompanied by reindeers, my lady.
A far cry from Labradors, I fear. Let us hope one of them is not Rudolph. I cannot abide a red nose.
Who are you, and what do you want with my family? I demand to know.
There is no further use in pretending, Father. This is Santa, and we are engaged to be married.
Yo ho ho!
I will not allow my daughter to throw away her life by marrying a ruddy-faced purveyor of cheap trinkets.
But how can this be?
Smelling salts, my lady.
Professor Christopher Ricks analyses one of the key songs in the seminal oeuvre of Sir Cliff Richard.
Congratulations and celebrations when I tell all the world that you're in love with me. Congratulations and jubilations. I want the world to know I'm happy as can be. The hard C of congratulations clashes against the sibilant soft C of celebrations. A name also given to a luxury selection of chocolates formed, tellingly, of centres both hard and soft. My own preference, incidentally, is for the soft, particularly the strawberry cream, like a knife through silk. The effect of emotional uneasiness is both maintained and reinforced by his devastating employment of words beginning with W, when, want, world, in the second and fourth lines. These W words, and the word word is, don't forget, itself a word beginning with W, carry echoes of the sadness inherent in words like woe, weep, and wail. In these lines, Cliff Richard is evidently semaphoring his own turbulent state of mind by turns desperate for the acclaim of the entire world population, for his struggle towards happiness, I want the world to know, yet at the same time poignantly aware that his contentment is only relative. I'm as happy as can be, to his own, perhaps even greater capacity for a bitter and brooding unhappiness. In the third line, jubilations, with all its Old Testament echoes of judgment and retribution, rhymes precisely, uncannily, and with an uncanny precision with the congratulations of the title. And there is an undeniable sexual tension, too, in Richard's prolonged rendition of the lay in jubilations and congratulations when set against the emphatically standoffish shun of jubilations and congratulations. Seduction versus rejection. It is the greatest artists who take risks, and what could be riskier than for Cliff to bear his deepest sexual misgivings with such purgatory bravado?
And now a piece of very lyrical prose from Jeanette Winterson.
What are you that makes me feel thus? Are you thus what makes me feel that? Feel me thus, that you makes what are. You are my winged Pegasus, my hirsute daffodil, my sea urchin of song, my orangutan pirouetting on a high wire, my banana unpeeled, my mango spurting vertiginous aspidistras over the umbrous concavities of Sappho's juts and nukes. I close my beautiful brown, deep brown, soft brown eyes. My lips, like smoked salmon wrapped in cream cheese parcels with a sprig of fennel, moist, urgent, costly, but on special offer, meet your lips, as fresh and nutritious as the morning's cod. My tongue laps your lips are lapped, and lapping lips slip lappingly, like lollipops over lip laps slapped slippingly. You affect me as a young gazelle affects the mountain over which it lollops, dollops, and bollops.
Away from Brownton Abbey, Bates is up on a murder charge.
Mr. Bates, you are charged with the murder of your deeply unpleasant and vengeful wife. How do you plead?
Gloomy, my lord.
I overheard him saying, I'll kill the first Mrs. Bates with my own hands, even if I have to swing for it. I thought nothing of it at the time.
He never did nothing, my lord. He's as gentle as the day is long.
Members of the jury, what is your verdict? Guilty or not guilty?
Having considered the matter, my lord, we, the members of the jury, have come to the conclusion that the defendant is...
The court will now retire for an advertisement break.
Now, Cookery Corner with the Duchess of Devonshire.
I was intrigued to learn recently that there is now a product on the market which can turn bread into toast without any need for all the palaver of toasting fork, fire, butler, and so forth. This splendidly ingenious contraption is called a toaster, comes in a variety of colours, and can be obtained from many leading shops. What on earth will they think of next? Andrew and I now spend many a happy hour making toast by simply placing a slice of bread, which now comes ready sliced, would you believe, into the slot in the toaster, pressing the button down and waiting a minute or two before it pops up. If one wants a second slice, one simply buys another toaster and repeats exactly the same moves again. Buttering the toast is another matter, which we feel safest leaving to our excellent cook. Isn't it about time someone invented a contraption so that buttering, too, became the proverbial piece of cake?
From the archive, Harold Pinter recites his very own selection from the Oxford Book of English Verse.
The Lake Isle of Innisfree. I will arise and go now, and go to Innisfree. and a small cabin built there, of clay and wattles made. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honey bee, until the Yanks come along and fuck the shit out of it! I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high o'er vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils. And I said, "Come on, Lady Antonia, get your coat on. I'm not standing for any more of this fucking nonsense. Those fucking daffodils have got it in for us. It's free speech they can't abide." I remember the house where I was born, the little window where the sun came peeping in at morn. He never came a wink too soon, nor brought too long a day. But now I often wish the night would have sodomized him up the fucking ass! God rest ye merry, gentlemen. Let nothing you dismay. Except you've just had the shit blown out of you, so you're not so fucking merry now, are you, chums?
At Brownton Abbey, winter is taking its toll. Remind me, Carson, what is that white, flaky material falling from the sky?
Snow, my lord. We're experiencing a chilly snap, my lord.
And what, may one be so bold as to ask, is a chilly snap? In my day, it was never a snap, but a spell.
I only hope poor Captain Scott and his team have wrapped up well. I hear Telly can prove decidedly nippy on the polar ice cap. It would be the most frightful luck if anything untoward were to happen to them.
Might I have a word, my lord?
Can't it wait, Carson?
This telegram has just arrived, my lord.
My goodness, Carson, it's postmarked the South Pole. Who on earth could have sent that? Let's see what it says. Regret, have just died of the cold, stop. Sadly unable to join you for dinner, stop. Captain Scott and team, stop. This means we shall be 7 fewer for dinner, Carson. Would you be so good as to remove the surplus chairs?
Frozen to death. So thoughtless. After all the trouble Mrs. Patmore had been to with her chicken pie.
It's terribly chilly outside. I dearly hope there hasn't been a terrible build-up of snow and her ladyship doesn't go and get herself buried alive in an avalanche.
I love terrible build-ups of snow and the upper classes buried alive in avalanches.
Me too.
Are you thinking what I'm thinking?
I'd never forgive myself. Well, okay then, Thomas. Just this once.
Well.
Carson, I think I may have underestimated young Thomas. Up to now, I regret to say I considered him lazy and untrustworthy. But I've now altered my opinion. I've just spotted him hard at work with O'Brien, shoveling all that wretched snow into one huge, magnificent pile just by the path where my beloved wife takes her morning walk. I now realise that, far from being feckless, Thomas is in fact a most thoughtful and hard-working young man. Mary, you look flustered. Is anything the trouble?
Come quickly, everybody. There's been the most frightful avalanche. Mother is buried alive underneath the snow. If one listens hard, Father, one can just hear her whimpering your name. Robert! Robert!
An avalanche? How very common.
My poor Cora buried beneath an avalanche. I'll change at once. Carson, bring me my warmest tweed suit with matching socks, together with my green woolen cape and perhaps my new leather boots. But first, do please make sure they're well polished. And the mink cufflinks too, if you would. And be quick about it, Carson. There's no time to lose.
Might I have a word, my lord?
Can't it wait, Carson? I'm up to my neck in snow and currently experiencing the most frightful difficulties. Just when I'm struggling to dig my wife out of an avalanche, my splendid new tweed hat keeps falling off. I shall never forgive myself for ordering it one size too large.
Robert! Robert!
There's an unexpected visitor at the front door, my lord.
Not another Carson. How many more, Carson?
The queue of unexpected visitors currently numbers 25, my lord. This one answers to the name of the Abominable Snowman, my lord.
I have no wish to speak to a snowman.
Really, Robert, he is not just any old snowman. This is the Abominable Snowman. The Abominables are one of the leading Tibetan snowman families. We danced together in our youth, Lord Abominable and I. Why, he even let me call him a yeti. He melted in my arms.
Gentleman says it's urgent, my lord. Shall I show him in?
Robert! Robert, save me!
I'm sorry, Cora, but it'll have to wait. I have urgent business to which to attend.
Help! Help!
No true aristocrat would ever call for help. Snow is a great leveller, I fear.
We now present a modernised version of Enid Blyton's classic Famous Five, taking into account health and safety. The next morning, the Famous Five awoke early, eager to embark on their big adventure. They planned to take the pony and trap to the water's edge, then row over to the island at low tide.
Wizard,
said Dick. The Famous Five rushed out of Kirin Cottage, bubbling over with excitement.
Don't forget to tie your shoes up tight, children,
shouted George's father after them.
In some areas of the country, up to 2% of admissions to casualty are caused by people failing to tie their shoes up tight, sometimes resulting in hideously crippling injuries.
Having double-checked their laces, the children climbed into the trap.
Has everybody got their high-factor skin protection lotion on?
Asked George's mother.
After all, the sun might come out, and we don't want you catching skin cancer now, do we? Yes, mother,
sighed George.
And are you wearing your protective clothing?
Piped up George's father.
An increasing number of children are allergic to grass, and watch out for flies, wasps, buttercups, cattle, birds and life-threatening flowers. And don't fall into a cow patch or you'll go blind.
Soon they were ready for offs. Julian was saying,
Giddy up.
When a strange man appeared before them.
Halt,
said the strange man.
Do you have a license for this pony and trap? And are you all over the age of 18? And I trust you are all in possession of the necessary government trap proficiency certificates.
Gosh,
said Julian despondently.
Who are you?
I am your local health and safety officer,
said the man grudgingly.
And I advise you to alight from that vehicle.
From out of the blue, another man appeared alongside him, carrying a clipboard.
Who is the owner of this quadruped?
He barked.
I think you mean Freckles the pony,
exclaimed Julian proudly.
I am his master. And who are you?
Animal welfare,
replied the second man, brandishing a grand-looking badge.
This quadruped is not suitable for passenger haulage. And it constitutes a potential hazard to motor vehicles,
added a third man who, it turned out, was a senior figure in the Road Vehicles Inspectorate. At this point, poor Anne burst into tears.
Oi, oi! Textbook signs of potential child abuse,
observed a passing health visitor.
Tell us all about it, dear.
George gave a long, drawn-out sigh.
It looks like we'll have to walk to the sea,
she exclaimed. Agreed Timmy.
Here we are, at last,
exclaimed Dick, who was the first to catch sight of the sea, just past the sign saying, Danger, sea.
Gosh, what a lovely time we're going to have,
gasped George. George was dressed exactly like a boy in jeans and a jersey. George's mother and father had registered her with the local child psychologist, and George seemed to be responding pretty well. Julian began throwing pebbles into the sea.
To see how far you can send them is the most splendid fun,
he exclaimed.
But it's against the guidelines,
added an official from Heritage Coastline.
Not only is this coast subject to erosion, but a passing fish could be easily injured by one of those stones. And don't you kids realise you should never pick up a stone without a trained adult in attendance? It could have a sharp edge.
The five went off to the secret cave where they had hidden their boat the summer before.
I say, our cave's been filled in with cement,
said Dick.
This information board says that it's all part of the Department of the Environment's hugely successful Crackdown on Caves initiative. Oh, well,
sighed George.
We could always make a campfire and cook ourselves some bangers, I suppose.
But at that moment, an alarm sounded loud and clear. It was the local fire prevention officer arriving in his van with his friend from the Uncooked Sausages Inspectorate. So the famous five were forced to abandon their plans for a big adventure.
We could always have a small adventure, I suppose,
sighed Anne despairingly.
I know,
exclaimed Julian.
Let's all sit in front of the telly at home and stuff ourselves full of fatty foods. Last one to grow clinically obese is a sissy,
added Dick excitedly.
You have been listening to Eleanor Bron, Richard Ingrams, Paul Bailey, Tallulah Brown, Ian Wilson, and me, Craig Brown.